thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you to you all for coming. Thank you to Stevie and everybody else who's been helping sort of behind the scenes to set this up. I have to say, this is really daunting, just looking at the sea of faces and just the whole event, and obviously because of the day that we're doing this on. I'm just going to put the lights down, just to warn you. Okay. It was clear to me when I found out the date for this that it was what the Germans call Schicksalstag, which is the day of fate, which is beginning to feel a little bit more appropriate than I wish it did today. But it was the day in German history that big things tend to happen, like the capitulation after the First World War in 1918, or Hitler's beer hall putsch in 1923, or the Kristallnacht pogrom in 1938. They all happened on the 9th of November. But just to brighten the mood a bit, so the Berlin Wall fell down on the 9th of November too, so it's not all bad. Okay, so inevitably when you're doing your inaugural lecture like this, it makes you reflect on how you got here. And so the first thing I want to do is to acknowledge the support and the inspiration of so many people in this room, not least my mum and dad, and my family, Lance and Madeline and Adam, who are sitting there being very embarrassed right now. But it also makes you reflect on what it is that you have to profess. And it does strike me as I reflect on and try to flesh out the rather grandiose title that I've given myself, that this collection of rather abstract nouns does bear the traces of my intellectual journey from an undergraduate degree in German and politics through a doctorate in modern history to a career in media and cultural studies. In other words, I've always been interested in the interplay between communication, history, and politics in public life. But I haven't always been terribly interested in listening. And that, I suppose, is the first point that I want to make, that despite the fact that listening is and always has been a significant everyday activity in personal, political, and cultural life, it's an activity that either tends to be taken for granted or is dismissed as a merely passive form of reception, or is more likely simply ignored. And I have to admit, I pretty much ignored it in my early work, even though the topic of my research was radio, where listening is really quite a big deal. As a young feminist scholar of German history, I'd come to radio rather accidentally as a site to explore the representations of women in the first half of the 20th century. Films and magazines would have been perhaps more obvious, more glamorous places to look for images of women, but there were already lots of work done there. And it turned out I was perversely attracted to the challenge of researching images of women in a medium where there are no images, and from a time in history where there was either no technology or little inclination to record the ephemeral programs that were sent out across the airwaves. To be honest, if I'd actually had to listen to much early German radio, I might not have stuck with it. But as it was, turning to the available archives of production notes and public commentary, I became fascinated by the connections between the story of women emerging from the private home into the public sphere and the story of radio emerging as a revolutionary new form of communication which could bring the public world of politics and culture directly into the home. These connections turned out to be complex and often contradictory, but a connecting theme was about finding a voice in the new democracy of the Weimar Republic, whose constitution, in the wake of defeat in the First World War, had enshrined both the freedom of speech and granted women the vote. The radio, which launched just 4 years later in 1923, offered a new platform for women's voices and for women's issues to be aired in public, while women's presence in the production and, crucially, the reception of radio fundamentally shaped the way in which broadcasting found its place as a site of authority, learning to speak in a voice that was both public and intimate. So this was a moment of great progressive potential, a radical extension of the democratic public sphere. Here was a new public space that could build bridges between public and private, between classes and regions, between high and low culture, so-called. A new public space which could enable a wider range of voices than ever before to speak to each other in new ways that extended political and cultural discourse into everyday vernaculars and routines. A new form of communication which could inspire new creative forms to inform, educate, and entertain a listenership whose participants could, in principle, include every citizen. Within a decade, it had become the mouthpiece of the Nazi regime. There's so much to say about that, of course, and it's not a straightforward history, and I shouldn't draw straightforward parallels. But what does stand out above all else from this period of German history, from the perspective of 2016, maybe precisely November the 9th, 2016, is the fragility of the democratic enterprise in the face of demagogic nationalist populism. And actually, it is striking how much closer that history feels in time now than it did 30 years ago when I was starting out on that research. Maybe it was just the naivety of youth, but the threat of proto-fascism existing beyond the extreme fringes of the political scene seemed at least a more distant prospect during a time when we were seeing the rise of pro-democracy movements around the world, the ending of apartheid, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and, dare I say it, the vision of an ever closer union in Europe. But that's how optimistic I was feeling in November 1989 when the wall came down, and it's so sad that we're talking about building walls up again. But the other reason that the history seems closer now is that when I began doing that research, I didn't even have a typewriter, let alone access to the internet. While that could be an excuse to wax nostalgic or to reflect on how much harder it was to do research in those days, the point is really that in the late 80s, the media landscape had been pretty stable for decades. The press, cinema, and broadcasting pretty much covered it. Since then, we have all experienced the emergence of radically new forms of communication with all the attendant hopes and fears. In other words, it's much easier now to understand the contingency of radio as an emerging medium, the excitements and resentments it generated, and the debates and power struggles that raged over its disruptive and transformative potential. It's also easier to understand just how rapidly a new medium can become established and yet still be unevenly adopted and continually adapted. Those of us who were born analog, something, of course, that is only remotely sayable since people have started being born digital, we can still find ourselves talking about new media decades after the internet became part of everyday life. And much of what I want to say today is actually framed by this understanding of how new media forms are shaped by the residual framing of older media forms. In particular, I'm interested in how the audiovisual media of the 20th century emerged into a culture dominated by literacy, and how we celebrate the apparent interactivity of digital media in part because of the residual framing of a century of broadcasting. So anyway, there I am in the early 90s with a PhD in German history, casting around for jobs, and among the many places that rejected me was Sussex, where I had applied for a lectureship in German in the School of European Studies, sadly departed of this parish. Despite this snub, this is actually where I want to pause to pay tribute to the extraordinary debt that I owe to the interdisciplinary culture at this university. In those days, appointments panels always had representatives from different schools on them. And I had the good fortune that the late Roger Silverstone, the newly appointed professor of the newly established media subject group, was the interdisciplinary representative on the panel for the German job. Having seen my application, he rang to ask if I'd like to be considered for a job in media and cultural studies instead. It had never honestly occurred to me that I was anything other than a Germanist or a historian, but I was living on the dole in Tottenham at the time, so it seemed worth a punt. And actually, I should say that the other surprise when I got that job was that I discovered that my brother, who's here today, my older brother, had just signed up to be a student in media studies at that point, so he was a bit shocked as well. But he's come back for more lectures, so that's quite touching. So, before I knew it, I was teaching all sorts of things I didn't know much about, but I was learning a lot. And it was through teaching film and television in particular, where there's this vast literature on the politics of spectatorship, that made me realize how little was written in media and cultural studies about listenership. So little, in fact, that that's barely even a word. And it was teaching courses on media and modernity and reading about how the technologies of print and photography and the moving image have changed the ways we think and see, that made me start wondering about what the impact of sound media has been on ways of listening, and how those new ways of listening, in turn, might have impacted on the ways in which we do politics. And it was certainly working in a place that facilitated and encouraged the crossing of disciplinary divides and the privilege of working alongside and listening to some brilliant colleagues and students, so many here today, so nice, that I began to be able to bring all of those different things together and to find my own intellectual voice. So, finding a voice, speaking up, being represented. All of this is important in the history and theory of media, of identity, and democratic citizenship, and has been the subject of much scholarship. But what is a voice without a listener? If the phrase finding a voice reminds us of how speaking up in public, even in well-established democracies, is a practice that has to be learned, honed, struggled for, defended, then isn't learning to listen also a process, also a struggle? We all listen to stuff all the time. We don't remember how we learned to listen in the way that we remember learning to speak, or read, or write. In fact, as Paddy Scannell, who's here tonight, my special guest, has reminded us, listening is how we get into language in the first place. It seems to us to come as naturally as hearing, and this might account for how little thought we give to it, or how counterintuitive it can seem to think of listening as a cultural practice that changes over time and is subject to the contingencies of history, place, and material conditions. Having said that, there is certainly a huge volume of literature, both academic and popular, that recognizes listening as cultural work, with all sorts of manuals about how to hone the skill of listening in therapeutic or pedagogic, professional or interpersonal situations, or about refining the art of listening in terms of developing a musical ear, for example. But these approaches tend to concentrate on the psychology, acumen, or taste formation of the individual listener, rather than on listeners as members of a public, let alone as part of a public sphere that has profoundly affected the experience of listening since the advent of mediated sound around the turn of the 20th century. Now, despite my interest in listening and the media, I'm not a great one for playing clips in my lectures, but I couldn't resist playing you this report on Radio 4's Today programme from a couple of years ago about an amazing digital reconstruction of the world's very first sound recording.
American historians have discovered what they think is the earliest recording of the human voice, made on a device which scratched sound waves onto paper blackened by smoke. It was made in 1860, 17 years before Thomas Edison first demonstrated the gramophone, and featured an excerpt from a French song, Au clair de la lune. The award-winning screenwriter Abby Mann has died at the age of 80. He won an Academy Award in 1961 for Judgment at Nuremberg. Abby Mann also won several Emmys, including one in 1973 for a film which featured a police detective called... The character on whom a long-running TV series was eventually based.
It's 10 minutes past eight.
Of course, I play that for obvious reasons, and there are otherwise not many laughs in this lecture, and I think we could do with a laugh today. But I also play it because it reminds us, I think, of just how profoundly uncanny and mysterious were these early encounters with the disembodied voice. After all, until the modern age, the disembodied voice belonged either to the realm of the sacred, the magical, or the supernatural. Sound had never before, in the course of human history, been stored as sound. In other words, this phone autograph recording represents a moment of the highest significance, a paradigmatic shift in representational practice, and as John Durham Peters has put it, perhaps the most radical of all sensory reorganizations in modernity. Yet for the 21st century listener, it was literally a laughable technological failure. It was laughable for not sounding like a voice in song, for not sounding like the real thing. As listeners, we have come to expect high fidelity reproduction in our sound media, whatever that sounds like at any particular technological moment. In other words, we've learned to listen past the mediation and have faith that sonic representations can connect us faithfully to the real world. This apparent connection to the real goes some way to explain how these promises of perfected sound have gone hand in hand with aspirations for a technologically reinvigorated democracy. Once you could faithfully record the human voice and other sounds, you could open up the parliaments, the courtrooms, the concert halls and the lecture theatres to whole new audiences listening elsewhere or sometime in the future. I could quote you Thomas Edison in the 1870s or Marconi or John Reith in the 1920s or any number of other people, including Carl Malamud, who launched the world's first streaming radio service in 1994, about how new technologies in recording and redistribution would provide greater, more immediate, more indiscriminate access to, participation in, and scrutiny of public life. No longer would public life have to go through the distancing effect of translating the spoken word into the code of writing. Public life could be experienced live and in all its liveliness through the act of listening. Public discourse until that point had been a muted affair, in the sense that unless citizens were within earshot of each other, their participation in the public sphere had to rely on the written word. The modern public sphere had been constituted as a reading public, reading that was mostly done silently to boot. Reading and writing in the Gutenberg galaxy had allowed the representation of the public back to itself as an imagined community, but in ways that were abstracted and disembodied. So the restoration to the public realm of the sounds of the human voice, with all its traces of embodied particularity, its emotional inflections, its intimate immediacy, therefore signaled a radical shift in terms of the access to and experience of public discourse. However, what this shift might mean for public life was bitterly contested. For every utopian hope that the spoken word would breathe new life into public culture, there was a dystopian fear that too few voices were being heard, and that those voices would become too powerful without the machinery of rejoinder, or more simply, the ability of listeners to speak back. Although it's rarely acknowledged in this way, many of the debates through the 20th century about whether the mass media of communication were a force for democratization or for standardization and control hang on the extent to which listening was acknowledged as a critical activity like reading, or was associated simply with passive and uncritical reception. This is hugely significant in various ways that I'll come back to, but the main point for now is to recognise how sounds in modernity could be heard by listeners separated in time and space, and yet engaged through the sonic address. I've now lost my place. So they could be engaged through the sonic address, real or latent, into some sort of communion with others, near or far. It's also worth saying that the development, domestication, disciplining and democratisation of these new forms of listening was neither inevitable nor straightforward, but they are by now long established and for most listeners automatic. Through the practice, in both senses of the word, of listening to mediated sounds on the phone, on the radio, on record, in film and television and online, in public and private spaces, alone and together, listeners have adapted their expectations, their experience, and their expertise. The quotidian listening experience is now characterized by easy and unremarkable encounters with sounds from any number of sources, which are choosable, manipulable, controllable, storable, shareable. Sounds that might be listened to with the passion of an audiophile through the focus of high-spec headphones, or as a companionable or disruptive backdrop to other activities. Sounds that might be scheduled or serendipitously encountered. Sounds that might be dislocated from their source or bonded visually to them. Sounds that might be ephemeral or infinitely repeatable. Sounds that might evoke emotions and memories through their familiarity or inspire curiosity or irritation through their novelty. Sounds that ground a listener in a particular time and space or that transport them somewhere. Sounds that make a listener turn inward or reveal connections with invisible or distant others, sounds that inform, educate, and entertain, sounds that belong, and sounds that startle. Sometimes listeners will reflect on these sounds explicitly as listening experiences, sometimes not. But this is the reality of ordinary listening in the media age, in all its extraordinary complexity and diversity. And I think this is important to say, because I do think it's too easy to take listening for granted, and it is something that changes over time and in relation to different sounds and contexts. But for the argument I want to make, it's actually a bit of a red herring, or at least it's just the first step in understanding how learning to listen is the corollary of finding a voice. Although my interest in listening did come from thinking about radio and people's engagement with the changing sonic landscape, in fact, it's led me to understand that listening is a critical category with a much wider application in media and political theory. First of all, bringing sonic metaphors into critical and political discourses that are dominated by the language of visual culture, points of view, perspectives, enlightenment, and so on, can, I think, shed new light on various blind spots, or should I say amplify things that have perhaps been overlooked, I mean overheard. Oh no, that doesn't work. Perhaps I mean muted. Anyway, see, oops, how much our language is shot through with the visual. And although things are getting better with the supersonic rise of sound studies over the last decade or so, it is still the case that most treatments of listening within media and cultural studies tend to privilege the action of listening into something, to use the telling phrase adopted in the early years of radio. Listening is something produced by a text. Note how that's a word that belies how much we still think about communication in the language of reading and writing. And listening to a text produces a listenership that can be counted, packaged, or exchanged. In fact, in the spirit of historical semantics, it's interesting to note that the OED offers listenership only as a noun to describe the estimated number of listeners to a broadcast program or to radio, whereas it offers a definition of spectatorship as the state of being a spectator or beholder. In short, listenership is the quantitative product of a media event, while spectatorship is an existential condition. And basically, I want to take issue with that definition and suggest that the modern technologies of mediation have, in fact, contributed to the production of listenership not only as a collective noun, but as a state of being and a civic disposition. Specifically, I want to draw attention to the public aspect of listening, an aspect which has at least as much to do with listening out as listening in. Listening as a radical form of openness, literally Öffentlichkeit, the German term commonly, if confusingly, translated as the public sphere. In other words, the main reason I think that listening needs to be taken seriously in thinking about media and public culture is that listening as a communicative and participatory act is necessarily and inescapably political. Of course, listening does from time to time enter the language of everyday contemporary politics. Politicians, particularly when on the back foot, pledge to listen to the people. In an attempt to re-engage a disaffected electorate, the political classes are keen not to appear to be talking at the voters, but listening to them. Commentators trying to understand the Brexit vote or the Trump phenomenon it was when I wrote this, the Trump victory, will often say that the establishment has failed to listen or turned a deaf ear to vast swathes of the disaffected electorate. Leaving that to one side, and I think they probably are the most important questions, but the point I want to make in terms of the argument I'm building is that these kinds of emphasis on the politics of listening, rather than marking a bold new departure, actually serve to draw attention to the neglected role that listening has always played in the public sphere, both as an embodied activity and as a metaphor for an interactive politics. But I'd also say that this formulation of listening to the public is in some important way skewed by the politics of voice. Listening is a way of being respectful of the electorate, listening to them in all their diversity and being open to hear the variety of their responses. But if listening to citizens is vital to the production of trust in political exchanges, then listening as citizens is no less important. So in order to make this argument, we can go back to basics, to the idea of listening itself. To listen is both an intransitive and a transitive verb. In other words, it is possible to listen without necessarily listening to anything. Listening can therefore be understood as being in a state of anticipation, of listening out for something. The listening public, in this more metaphorical sense, is an always latent public, attentive but indeterminate. Anyone who speaks up in the public sphere does so in the hope or faith or expectation that there is a public out there ready to listen and to engage. So that presupposes that there are people ready to listen out for whatever they might want to say, ready to listen, in other words, before they actually start listening in. We're familiar with the idea of the reading public, an idea that suggests a potential, the sum of people with a critical skill of literacy, rather than the readers of any one particular publication. Yet the idea of the audience that emerged with the audiovisual media has tended to be associated with particular texts, with no connotations of latent critical practice. The extension of democracy in the 19th and early 20th centuries was matched broadly by a political will to extend literacy to all sections of the population. But as the weight of political representation has shifted from print to audiovisual media, the equivalent political will was lacking to extend literacy programs to audiovisual media that seem not to require specialist skills to be deciphered. The subject of media studies is still often met with derision in the political sphere. Current discussions of information information literacy tend to focus on technical rather than critical dimensions, while media literacy in the age of digital participatory culture tends to focus on productive rather than receptive skills, how to post or blog or sample, edit, podcast or mashup and so on. Of course, I exaggerate for effect, there are plenty of people calling for critical self-reflexivity in the decoding of the digital media. But a focus on listening out would suggest, I think, moving beyond the analogy of literacy, beyond a model of encoding and decoding, towards an ethics of active and intentional openness, and thinking of listeners not only as audiences in the public sphere, but also auditors of the public sphere. So basically, I want to suggest that it is in this analytical separation of listening out, an attentive and anticipatory communicative disposition, the difference from that to listening in, which is a receptive and mediatized communicative activity, it's in this space that we open up somewhere to consider listening as political and ethical action. Of course, it would be absurd to claim listening as a self-sufficient political activity. My point is simply that it is equally absurd and potentially dangerous that listening in the public sphere has for so long been overlooked. I want to argue that we ought to talk about the freedom of listening in the same breath as the freedom of speech. At one level, that's simply logical. Without a listener, speech is nothing but noise in the ether. More to the point, without a listener, there would be no reason, no calling to speak. Believe me, I wouldn't be talking to you if you weren't there. And if the speaker is not also at turns a listener, only a perverted version of communication remains. However, to play with the metaphor of the two-way dialogue is problematic. It might be more apposite to consider speech as resonating with a listener. Resonance is a property of acoustic space that is a form of causality, but not the linear causality associated with visual culture. Resonance is about responsiveness, but it need not be responsiveness in kind. A speech can resonate with a listener without the listener responding in speech, or indeed responding straight away. Moreover, resonance can also generate a great deal of acoustic energy from a small sound event. So, to continue the analogy, the speech act can be amplified in the way it resonates with those listening. So, a listener's response may not be verbally articulated and may not follow immediately, but this does not diminish the fact that all listening is always actively responsive. Indeed, it can be argued that politics at its most basic level is the dynamic between the act of speech and the act of listening. The speech act alone is static. Only the presence of an active listener introduces the political dynamic, introduces the element of intersubjectivity. Speaker and listener are mutually interdependent, but it is the openness of the listening position on either side which produces the space in and across which communication can take place. Following Hannah Arendt, this in-between, this sense of relatedness and difference, is both the precondition and the motivation for communication and for politics. Communication is only possible because of the similarities we share in the human condition, and only necessary because of the inevitable differences and space between us. Of course, pluralism as a democratic virtue is normally conceived of in terms of a plurality of voices guaranteed by the freedom of speech. But plurality, I would argue, also has to be guaranteed by the freedom of listening. This is more than just a question of simply being heard. Hearing is not yet listening. Plurality is guaranteed by the freedom of listening, not only because an individual inhabits plurality in the act of listening more than in the act of speaking. We can, and often do, in fact we most often do, listen alongside others without losing our individuality. Again, I'll use you as my example. But I also propose the freedom of listening because it's only in listening that we can apprehend and acknowledge the plurality of voices. If we think of the public sphere as an auditorium where the freedom of speech is exercised, then it is the listeners who become the auditors of public exchanges and performances. Listeners, in other words, hold the responsibility not to close their ears to expressions or opinions with which they might not agree, and by extension, to ensure that the whole spectrum of opinion gets to be heard. Plurality is not, in fact, guaranteed by the freedom of speech, or at least not by freedom of speech alone. For those who speak might all speak with the same voice, either through choice, coercion, or the conditions of the marketplace. It is in the freedom of listening that limitations on plurality are registered, whether that be the dominance of certain voices or the absence, marginalization, and censorship of others. Listening in this way forms the bedrock of a democratic practice. There is undoubtedly a certain courage required in this listening out, in this political listening, the courage to be open to the opinions of others, neither refusing to listen, nor simply identifying uncritically and selflessly with the position of the speaker. It requires an attitude somewhere between sheer defiance and sheer docility. I am proposing the freedom of listening then as a normative ideal distinct from the freedom to listen. The freedom to listen, understood in terms of a right of access to and participation in public debate, is, of course, integral to any practical definition of democracy. However, when the freedom to listen is understood only as a right and not also as a responsibility, it is a poorer guarantor of plurality. For listeners might decide to exercise their right to listen only to those speakers whose opinions resonate with their own. This constitutes a refusal to listen, itself a powerful exercise of power and censorship. I think for those reasons that the sonic vocabulary of speech and listening can refresh old questions about communicative politics and perhaps point us in new directions. It might be time to finally throw off the jargon of literacy that we've inherited from the print age and come up with something more fitting to the digital age. This is more than just word games, since reading is, broadly speaking, a privatized and abstracted activity, whereas listening is potentially, at least, both shareable and embodied. As media becomes more immersive, so do the three-dimensional spherical properties of sound and listening become richer analytical tools to understand our mediated relationships. This is no more than McLuhan was arguing in terms of the shift from a print to an electronic culture, from literacy to secondary orality. More to the point, the extent to which being connected in the digital age is to exist in something like a permanent state of receptivity makes the act of consuming social media, even in the written form of text, more like listening than reading, in the sense of listening out for the next iteration in an unfolding and unstable multi-textual universe. Okay, I think that's enough abstraction for this time of night. It might be helpful to think about how this plays out in relation to some concrete examples from the current media scene. And although I do want to make the case that the freedom of listening isn't just about sound media, in the same way that we're happy to talk about reading a film, I've recently become interested in a crop of social media that use sound and voice rather than the written word as the central medium of communication. Social media are ostensibly all about communicating sociably and in real time. The promotional framing of these new audio apps is that with vocalization, the social media are ready to go back to the primary communicative exchange of speaking and listening. Audio tweeting or audio blogging is described as easier, more natural, more authentic, a better way of conveying personality and emotion than with the sterility of text, the artifice of the keyboard, the labor of tapping 140 characters, or the kitschiness of emoticons. The banner headline on the VoiceThread social media site states, "Text can't replace you," next to a sad emoticon superimposed on a young boy's photo. And further down the page adds, "Voice threading is a more human way to connect." There is then, as with so many earlier media innovations, a certain nostalgia and reverence for unmediated communication, for face-to-face dialogue running through much of this promotional discourse, or implicit faith in the imminent achievement of that sublime technological moment when the apparatus of mediation dissolves back into nature. But there's a still more striking aspect, I think, to the way that these apps promote themselves. They tend to be sold to users in terms of getting their voices heard, loud and clear. Indeed, it's striking how often verbs like shout and boast and brag are associated with microcasting and audio blogging platforms with such noisy names as Shoutcast, Audio Boom, Hubbub, Yappy, Boast, and Shoutomatic, the last of which celebrates the fact that at last the world is within shouting distance. In other words, these vocal social media are often promoted in rather anti-social terms. This appeal to getting your voice heard is there in the tagline for more mainstream platforms too, like YouTube, which for a long time invited you to broadcast yourself. Slogans like these seamlessly mobilize two powerful ideas, the sovereign power of the individual and the inalienable right to freedom of expression. Of course, at one level, these kinds of statements are just run-of-the-mill advertising hyperbole, but they also speak directly to the ideology of neoliberal individualism and underscore the impression that everyone who has a voice has something to say and that the world is waiting to hear it. What is striking about these kinds of formulations from a media historical point of view is the way in which they are tapping into an idea of broadcasting, but stripping away almost every vestige of its heritage as a collective endeavor at either the level of production or reception. Apart from the question about whether there is really such a large and willing audience for these individualized sound bites, there is an odd contradiction at play here. As the marketing speaks to the desire both for a decentralization of broadcasting to the point where every individual has a voice, and at the same time to the desire for each individual voice to be precisely at the center of a network of millions to be listened to across the world. Those listening millions are not defined as individuals, but are conjured up as an indeterminate mass, an image that was problematic even at the height of monolithic media, but that jars even more in relation to the supposedly dispersed and disaggregated multiple publics of the digital age. The rhetoric of decentralization, in other words, openly mobilizes narcissistic fantasies of propagandistic power in a radical move that at the same time promises to strip broadcasting of its heritage as some sort of collective endeavor. It doesn't matter that everyone involved, the app developers, the advertisers, the consumers, sees through the hype. This knowing disavowal is how a commodity fetish works. We know, but all the same. There are also mobile apps that offer a platform to curate audio and other digital material in a personalized stream that is described as radio, or even smart radio. While most concentrate on music and entertainment, there are also versions dedicated to news and journalism. News aggregators that produce personalized feeds in textual form are common, but improving text-to-speech technology is now allowing these feeds to be streamed in sound. And one striking example of this is the iOS app Winston, which has been described as your Siri personal assistant for news. Winston's voice is that of a charming and indefatigable English butler, as imagined by American popular culture at least, who will prepare and serve you up the news and social media posts of your choice at your convenience. Once again, the technological potential to engage with the outside world is framed in terms of the world being served, like bespoke and neatly ironed newspapers over breakfast for the aristocratic individual at the center of his or her own universe. It's easy to see how the techniques of producing personalized programming and the rise of earphone culture together privilege listening as an intensely private rather than a public activity and tend to close down the possibilities for mediated encounters with the other. But while it's easy to critique the distorting effects of this sort of echo chamber, the technological affordances of any of the platforms discussed here are in principle neutral. Or rather, their meaning or social application is not predetermined by the technology in any straightforward way. It might be a very good thing for people to garner their news from a variety of sources and have them delivered in a convenient format that enables them to keep abreast of the affairs of the world. And that might, of course, be a very good thing for democratic values like plurality and political participation. But the notion of the public good is not something that often appears in the promotional framing or the user guidelines of these applications. Whatever the civic potential and evolution of this re-oralized public sphere, its news users are primarily being drafted in, not in their identity as citizens, but as apparently sovereign consumers. At the same time, that sovereignty is quietly compromised by institutional, psychological, and algorithmic mechanisms that are in play to direct listeners to familiar, homely sites. In saying this, though, it's worth noting that pessimism about the lack of courage or wherewithal to escape the comfort zone of conformity and deference is a recurrent trope as far back as Kant. So we should be careful about assuming that this fits a simple narrative of decline from some past golden age of cosmopolitan listening. A final contradictory aspect of this new media landscape to mention is the way in which listening is newly represented and exchanged. Listening has long been overlooked precisely because of the difficulty of representing or capturing it. The freedom of expression is enshrined as a democratic human right, not least because it was first conceived of as a property right. The things that people said and wrote could be straightforwardly identified and attributed to individuals as their property. The act of listening could not be so conceived. With radio, various techniques were gradually developed to capture and measure, analyze and commodify listening, but it was almost exclusively an activity undertaken by large institutions. Now listening is a practice that is increasingly surveyed and open to measurement and commodification, not just by these large corporations, but by individual listeners who are just a little media savvy. Listening, in the process, takes on the attributes of information, of property and commodity, and is tied down to the circulation of texts. So the surveillance and commodification of listening join with the personalization, the networking, and the specialization of digital audio to produce heightened forms of the privatization of the public potential of listening. There is certainly a lot to listen to, but all too easily the proliferation of forms and formats for individual expression is assumed to be the same as a plurality of voices, which in turn is taken to be the marker of a properly functioning communicative democracy. But as I said before, plurality has to be guaranteed by the freedom of listening as well. And this last slide is for my kids. So, to be clear then, listening out for otherness, for plurality, can be conceived therefore not just as a form of media literacy, but as a civic obligation. It is not for nothing that we speak of giving someone a fair hearing. Listening out in this sense is not about the search for consensus or conformity, let alone the confirmation of already given tastes and opinions. Nor is it about the erasure or disregard of conflict or of different interests. The openness of listening out is about keeping channels of communication open across ongoing difference and conflicting interests. It is therefore a difficult, challenging and risk-laden responsibility at the best of times, and God knows it's difficult at times like this. But fostering a culture and practice of listening out could go a long way in protecting the digital environment as a place of wide horizons and diversity, and might remind us and our politicians to listen out for voices beyond our natural constituencies. In a globalized world of ubiquitous media, it is easier now to listen to a greater variety of voices more easily than ever before, more possible to listen out for difference and plurality. But there are also great countervailing forces, algorithmic, pragmatic, political, psychological and cultural, enticing us to listen in to more of the same. The struggle over the meanings and practices of listening has perhaps never been more urgent.